Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Ghost in the Hall by K.M. Avery. Narrated by Daniel Henning. Chapter 1. My name is Edward Campion. No, for the nerdy history buffs out there, not Edmund, Edward. And it's actually Ward, not Ed. Really, not Eddie. And anyone who tries to call me Ned, or God forbid, Neddy, will have their balls served up on a silver platter. Or maybe just a paper plate. I'm not exactly rolling in silver platters. Paper or mismatched thrift store flatware is what you get with me. So, my story. I was about 6 when wave 1 of the plague hit. Okay. So it wasn't really the plague, per se. There were no buboes on people's necks to indicate who was or wasn't infected. And the plague, the Black Death anyway, was a lot deadlier. That plague killed somewhere between 30% and 60% of Europe. This one only got something like 8% straight off, including my mother. Only a few weeks later, my father dropped me off with my mom's sister, my Aunt Pearl, in Baltimore. Then he turned around and drove himself straight back home, drank himself into a stupor, and wandered out into a snowbank in January in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, slipped into a coma, and never woke up. That made Dad part of the 9% who died as a result of the suicides and surging violence that followed in the wake of a global pandemic and the worldwide economic depression that resulted. Let me put this into perspective. The Spanish flu of 1918 impacted 1/3 of the global population, ditto with the arcanovirus. The Spanish flu killed between 3% and 5% of the population. The arcanovirus got 8%. Double. Add in the victims of suicide and violence, and it was responsible for the deaths of about 17% of the population. That's almost 2 out of every 10 people. Another 7% found themselves with bizarre new abilities, like talking to dead people, or knowing things about every object they touch, seeing the future. Or the past. The kinds of things we used to call being psychic or doing magic. And then there was the last, much to be pitied, 6%. People who changed as a result of contracting the disease rather than getting better or dying. Some of them thought they died, and they wished they had. Or rather, they sort of did die. They just didn't stay that way. No, not zombies. Those are still very much Hollywood only. Vampires, though, and ghouls, those are real. Imagine saying goodbye to Grandma in the hospital only to find that she woke up a few hours later and ate the face off the poor guy working the morgue. Those folks make a hell of a lot more in hazard pay these days. And most of them also wear neck guards and tool belts with a variety of ways to kill things. A little more permanently the second time around. Most ghouls don't make it back out of the morgue. I guess they're a bitch to wrestle into submission. And feed. The few that get successfully muzzled seem nice enough once they work through their hunger issues. Ditto for vampires. What that 6% became are known collectively as arcanids, or NIDs for short. There are a handful of arcanovirus metamorphoses. Some of them sprout fur and fangs. The shifters. Werewolves, werecats, were-whatevers. Turns out your genetics determine your were species. Upside, I've never heard of anybody being one by getting bitten. Ditto for vampires and ghouls, actually. The whole notion of turning someone is just a fairy tale. Either you're born that way to one or the other parent who's already an arcanid, or you get arcanovirus and end up that way. At least NIDs are immune to the arcanovirus. They can't even carry it, So if one of them bites you, you might have to worry about sepsis, or maybe even rabies, but you won't have to worry about the virus. There are other NIDs besides the Hollywood horror monsters, of course. Some aren't nearly as frightening. Elves, with their elongated bones and ears. And fauns, with horns and the legs and hooves of goats. And then there are orcs, with their greenish skin and lower fangs and muscular bulk. Bigger than most, sharper teeth, the protruding lower jaw with the sizable canines that are visible even when their mouths are closed. An awful lot of their families just reject them outright after they change. Talk about insult to injury. Scientists tried their best to find a cure, or at least a vaccine, and they failed. Early vaccine trials turned into new cases almost immediately. For this disease, there was no making the arcanovirus inert. No using a dead version, because when they tried it, the damn thing came back from the dead. Kind of like some of its victims. They tried creating mRNA vaccines. That just didn't work. The arcanovirus might look and act like a normal virus, but we're not talking about a cough here. It carries magic. Arcane abilities and attributes. It changes not just your DNA, which it does, by the way, but also something fundamental about your relationship to the metaphysical part of the world that science doesn't yet fully understand. Although, let me tell you, metaphysics came back as a discipline of academic study hardcore once we realized that magic was fucking real. Magic was real. And magic practitioners were real. In other words, some of the people who said they were witches really were witches. Entirely unrelated to the arcanovirus, by the way. Or at least they weren't given their abilities by it. One theory said that one of them caused it. Not on purpose. But one of them contracted a nasty virus, and that's where it picked up the magic that made arcanovirus arcane. But that's just a theory. In the aftermath of the pandemic, people did what people do best. They shunned. They ostracized. They praised the beautiful and rejected the ostensibly ugly. Those whose bodies were no longer considered acceptable to their families and friends banded together, forming communities and slums with others like them or others in similar situations. Not legally, of course. Legally, they had the same rights as everyone else. But since when has that mattered to humanity? The fauns, some of the shifters and vampires, managed to mingle. Some of them even managed to pass, shifters mostly, as human or human with brand new magic. The few surviving ghouls and the orcs, they lived mostly in segregated or low-income neighborhoods, working the jobs that no one else wanted to work and trying to live their lives under the proverbial radar. Only the elves managed to get by in the so-called normal world without too much effort. It was a repeat of the same age-old human bullshit. We don't manage to reduce racism based on melanin until we have something even more obvious, like fur or fangs, to use as a means of discrimination. Because even in the midst of a global pandemic, people continue to suck. The real kicker of the arcanovirus was that unless you ended up as a NID, you could get it again. And surviving it once was no guarantee that you'd live through it a second time. Or a third. The only upside of reinfection was that if you were still human after round one, you were going to stay human. If you did acquire some magic the first time, you weren't going to acquire new abilities in round two. Whatever you got the first time is what you got. So you could get really sick or die. But at least if you did recover, you were guaranteed to still look like you on the other side of it. But since there was no cure and no vaccine, pandemic protocols are still very much in effect. no sharing food or beverages with casual acquaintances, masks worn in public places, special UV filters on all forms of public transportation and in public buildings, lines and dots and arrows on the floor telling you where you can and can't go to stay away from other people. At least we figured out pretty quickly that sunlight kills it. So you can be outside without a mask and essentially no risk. And if you do come into contact with someone who falls sick or grows fangs, if the government catches you, you spend 72 hours in a room with people staring at you and swabbing your nose or poking you with needles to see if you develop either symptoms or antibodies. If you do, you go into an isolation ward in the hospital. Nothing, and you can go back home, a little more rumpled for the experience. Me? I'm what they call an arch-human. Still human, mostly. We come in several flavors, too, although you can't tell just by looking at us. At least not by looking at our bodies. A lot of arcs, at least those who accept what they are, wear the symbols of our newly acquired arcane abilities. It's funny, actually, to see your average middle-aged white yoga practitioner swathed in scarves, bangles, and wearing hoop earrings because she suddenly acquired the ability of foresight after 12 days of a nasty fever. Or the paunchy guy with a beard who wore flannel and carried a fishing pole before he went into the hospital and who suddenly has developed the taste for black leather and ankhs to go with his newfound ability to speak with the dead. That last one would be me. Even though the first wave hit when I was 6, I didn't catch it until 2 weeks after my 28th birthday. I'm not sure if it still counts as a pandemic once it's into its third decade or just the new normal, but life hasn't changed much from when I was a kid. For the most part, the citywide infection numbers are around a few hundred all the time. There are still larger outbreaks here and there, such as the one that hit my incredibly boring job maintaining the website of a massive and inhuman corporation that mostly just made money out of other people's money. Somebody came to work sick, despite all the policies that tell you not to, and it was somebody's birthday, so there were cupcakes in the break room that everybody took back to their cubicles and offices to eat. And since somebody had made those cupcakes, somebody had put their germs all over them, all over the napkins, and all over the plates they'd also brought. And then, over the next 3 days, everybody else ran around spreading it because they didn't realize they'd been exposed and were carrying it. More than 3/4 of the office went down. Most of them came back. Some of us never did, either because of long-term sickness, newly acquired arcane or NID status, or death. I lost the paunch during the 29 days of semi-delusional fever and vomiting, followed by 2 months in rehab while I relearned how to eat and walk, and figure out how to actually cope with the fact that I could now see and hear actual dead people. That took more than a little bit of getting used to. At least the black leather looks far better on me now than it ever would have before I caught the damn virus. It also only lasted about 6 months before I realized that it really wasn't me, and I went back to the old comfy jeans, t-shirts, and flannel, although I did ditch the beard. I mostly only grew it to hide the lack of jawline, which I have again now, thanks to the Arcana virus and my exciting new food allergies and nutritional processing problems. I take about 10 different prescription supplements and 2 antihistamines to help my body deal with the aftermath of Arcana. I keep the leather for the days when I need to look the part for a job. Some of my contracts are with law enforcement or pro bono cases for people whose sob stories get to me or Auntie Pearl, and they don't usually care what I look like. But when I take the better-paying gigs, they want a little drama to go with their dead. The higher the price tag, the more drama they expect. And since they're paying for it, I'm okay providing it. At least my new ARC skills mean that it doesn't matter that the soulless corporation fired me for not coming to work while I was busy puking my guts out and getting fed by tube so that I didn't join the 8% mortality rate. It only took about a year for me to get established as a medium, so now I have enough to pay back my own medical bills. When I've finally done that in a couple of years, I'm going to incrementally start paying Auntie Pearl back for the rest of it without her noticing, since she would be mad if she knew I was doing it because she thinks of me as her kid. Which, given that I've been with her since I was 6, I kind of am. All the more reason for me to try to pay her back, although I know I'll never be able to. But it isn't going to stop me from trying. All that was the reason why, on this particular day, I was in full leather gear, ankh around my neck, selenite studs in my ears, and a single amethyst in my right nostril to aid with spiritual communication. I'm not sure how much they actually help, but my birthday is in February, so I like wearing the amethyst anyway. I used to take it out every time I went to work, at the Heartless Corporation, because it didn't go with their so-called professional image. Suits and button-down shirts and chintzy bad ties aren't apparently complemented by an amethyst nose stud. To be honest, it usually clashes with the flannel, too. Men's flannel just doesn't tend to come in tones that complement amethyst. Not that I really care. Auntie Pearl usually has something to say about my lack of color coordination, although always with that telltale twinkle in her eye that says she doesn't really mind, especially since she's usually wearing at least one article of clothing or accessory displaying a cat. Sometimes a cat she actually owns. Like the sweatshirt I had made for her when I was 10 at that Put Your Photo on It store in the mall, which has a fairly terrible cutout photo of her now-deceased favorite black furball, Milton. Yes, the cat's name was Milton. Auntie Pearl loves books. Her first cat, one she had way back in her 20s, was named Shakespeare and lived to be almost 20. There's a picture of him on the fridge. Big Ginger Tom. At the moment, she has 4. Bertha, a giant white prima donna of a cat with long fur she can't keep at all orderly, so Pearl keeps having her shaved. Winston, a sleek gray cat with a white smudge on his forehead. Gatsby, an undersized hellion of an orange tabby. And Annabelle Lee, one of those weird hairless sphinx cats. My aunt calls her Belly. Pearl, also named Peveril, an oversized, long-haired, tan and brown fluffball of a cat that she rescued for me as a kitten when I was recovering on her couch. On the cat's side of the family, Bertha hates me, Winston and Gatsby tolerate me as belonging to Auntie Pearl, and Belly will accept pets on alternate Tuesdays and Sundays if there are treats involved. Pevs and I, of course, are best buds. He sleeps on my bed, eats my food, and keeps watch in the bathroom when I take showers. Peveril knows he's my cat and I'm his person, and the rest know exactly which hand fills their food bowls, not mine. Anyway, enough about the cats. Clearly, I don't have much of a social life. Back to me and the gig and leather pants. Leather pants, black cotton t-shirt, leather jacket, scarf instead of a conventional mask. All black, except the scarf, which was embroidered with silver and gold constellations. Silver ankh, selenite, and amethyst. Black leather belt with blue agate cabochons set in silver. Black leather boots. At least 4 cows have died for the making of my clothing. But I save up and buy high-end, so they last a while. And the jacket was actually my father's. One of the few things I have of his, since most of what he and Mom owned had to be sold to pay for their funerals. I and my dad's leather jacket pulled into one of those circular pull-through driveways owned primarily by the very wealthy. This one had a massive gate between 2 brick pillars, each topped with a cement or stone artichoke. For some reason I don't fully understand, artichokes, which are tasty but now borderline toxic to me, have somehow come to represent prosperity and wealth when cast in a rigid substance and mounted on top of things. When I pulled up, the valet, with his pale skin and beady, judgmental eyes, sniffed at my gray Highlander, with its rather obvious dings, scratches, and bird shit. A truck or car is a tool, and a tool is meant to be used. That, and I'm too lazy and too cheap to pay someone to wash it when the rain will come along and do it for me. And yes, before you ask, the word slob has been applied to me more than once. Although I take exception to that. I am not a slob. I shower daily. More than once if I've gotten dirty or sweaty or go out in public at all. I have excellent personal hygiene, and I do my laundry before I run out of clean socks or underwear. My car may be dirty and cluttered, but it's dirt and equipment and spray sanitizer, not trash. The backseat and trunk always have several bins and bags containing the trappings of my new trade. Crystals, candles, cremation ash, the bones of several different critters, all gathered post-mortem since I'm not big on killing animals for non-essential purposes, a few different types of incense, some essential oils, a hefty bundle or six of dried sage, matches, a lighter, salt, chalk, and several other odds and ends. For every gig, I make up a bag or bin matching the expectations of the client. My usual cases don't take much. Chalk, salt, baggies, sage, lighter. And usually I don't need most of that. For this one, I went all out. Wealthy clients expected trappings, smoke, and mirrors. Really wealthy clients expected all that and the bag of chips. All of which went into an elaborately carved, by Auntie Pearl, who was quite artistically talented, oak chest. It was lined with satin, embroidered with a collection of protective spiritual symbols. It was also mostly bullshit, honestly. Now that the world was full of the arcane, everyone went out of their way to become an expert in the spiritual resonances of various and sundry substances. For the most part, what this meant was that ridiculous superstitions were practically common knowledge, and everyone knew which woods were the most powerful for which rituals, which stones channeled spiritual energy, and which scents drew which kinds of spirits to the medium. Also, mostly bullshit. Mostly. Yeah, there's magic in wood and crystal and stone, but if you've got a real medium, you don't need any of it. Some things can help, some will get in your way, but most things are just that. Things. Trust me, as the guy the dead people talk to incessantly, I can personally attest to the fact that whether you burn patchouli or opium incense or a pile of dog shit doesn't make a damn bit of difference. But I've found that if you don't match people's expectations, they'll decide you're incompetent, whether you're the real thing or not. I'm definitely the real thing. But I'm also not above using theatrics in order to pad my paycheck when I can get away with it, at least when my client can afford it. So there I was, full leather despite the late summer date, shiny ankh, crystals, and carved oak trunk laden with candles, incense, crystals, and charms. It was going to be a big paycheck, assuming I didn't disappoint anyway, which I had no intention of doing. The ridiculously ornate mansion I and my carved trunk stood in front of belonged to Mr. Clifton Wallace Fitzwilliam and Mrs. Magdalene Forner Collins Fitzwilliam, the respective heirs to the Fitzwilliam and Forner Collins fortunes. They had, according to a brief spate of Googling, two children. Madison, a junior sorority sister at James Madison. Yeah, I know, Madison at Madison. And Connor, the high school senior captain of the lacrosse team at St. Christopher's. Both families, the Fitzwilliams and the Forner Collinses, had ties to old money, which, here in the South, meant plantation money. In their defense, their current piles of wealth had been mostly accumulated in the stock market and in toiletries, specifically hand sanitizer, soap, and moisturizing lotions. When the world is into the third decade of a deadly pandemic, the people who make sanitizer and soap and the lotion you need to counteract how much it dries out your hands are the richest of the rich. Not a day goes by that I don't wish my parents had left me stock in a soap company. They didn't. Although not poor, my parents didn't really have the liquid cash to play around in the stock market. Kind of like me and Auntie Pearl. Which is why I didn't feel at all bad about charging more than triple my usual rates for a private job. They wanted me to talk to their dearly departed patriarch, who died some 6 years ago and apparently left behind at least one illegitimate child who was coming to claim some stake in the family fortune that they, of course, didn't want to give him. The point of the seance was to determine A, if this child was actually an illegitimate Fitzwilliam, since said individual was refusing a DNA test, B, if there were any more they should be worried about creeping out of the woodwork, and C, where the hell he'd put his last will and testament, since several people, including the family lawyer, remembered him making it, but nobody seemed to know what had happened after that. Why they'd waited 6 years, I had no idea. Not part of my job description. Having removed my trunk and left the Highlander in the hands of the disdainful-looking valet, I turned to the door, which was already open, emitting a waft of cool, climate-controlled air into the mid-August heat. Standing in the doorway was an honest-to-God butler. The dark-skinned man was immaculately dressed, wearing a spotless white shirt and black suit, his hair smoothed back, and a black satin mask over the lower half of his face. Who the fuck has a butler these days?
Master Campion, I presume.
Master Campion? Apparently Mr. was too plebeian, or possibly too unsouthern, for the Forner Collins Fitzwilliam household. I felt bad for the butler, whose brown eyes flicked over me before looking up somewhere just past my shoulder. Edward Campion, yes. The rich who look down on me as nothing more than the help don't get to call me ward. Is there someone who can aid me in bringing in my equipment? I kept my tone appropriately submissive. While the household was undoubtedly going to be snobbish, there was no point in antagonizing the staff. The butler flicked his hand, and another employee, this one younger, blonde, and with a clearly fake tan, wearing a similar black and white outfit, minus the jacket, slipped past the butler to heft the trunk. As the butler turned, clearly expecting me to follow, I caught sight of a third person in the entry hall, and just about tripped over my shiny leather boots. I've been glared at before in my life, all the fucking time, in fact, but this was hate-filled. This wasn't just an I-don't-like-you glare. This was a full-on, if-I-could-suck-your-soul-out-through-your-eyeballs-I-would kind of glare. Disgust, repugnance, loathing, an I-want-you-deader-than-dead expression that was shocking both for its intensity and because I had no idea what I'd done to deserve it. I'd never in my life met the woman leveling it at me. I couldn't have. To judge by her clothing, she'd probably been dead a good century by the time I was even born. But it was abundantly clear that she did not approve of my existence. I was deeply relieved that she didn't follow us as the butler led me into the sitting room. My oak trunk had already been placed near a round table seated with five chairs. The butler looked down his nose at me. Not hard, since I'm not terribly tall, and asked if I needed anything else in a tone that clearly indicated he hoped I didn't. But having just weathered the world's strongest death glare from the dead woman in the hall, it didn't work. You wouldn't happen to be familiar with the family from, say, 100 years ago? I asked him. The surprise that flickered over his expression told me that he hadn't been expecting that,
"The family has been in this house since the 18th century," he replied, a little hesitant. I nodded, pleased.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?